accession number 27741, reel 3.
Say, this is reel 3, Michael LePage.
And but basically it was the same in the undercarriage, retractable undercarriage, flaps very important. They increase the drag on the wing so that you can land at a slower speed. You can see them all on modern aircraft, very complicated now. We just had one flap which came down underneath the wing, single engine monoplane, all very basic by comparison with today.
What was your opinion of the plane? Was it after the Harvard?
Oh, it was. I think it was an inline engine compared with the Harvard, which was a radial. But I'll come on to that later when we have the difference between the Seafire and the Hellcat, because that comes in there. But I think the Martin, the Master, was the inline engine meant that the cylinders were arranged in a line, one behind another, like a car engine. But the engine was so big that the nose was a long jutting out nose, which meant that landing was not so easy. Couldn't see so well. The radial engine, you like a mini Morris, you just look straight down onto there's this runway. But the inline engine, if you get into the stalling angle, the nose up, you can't see where you're going. And this was a particular difficulty in the Seafire, which, again, I'll come on to in a moment.
So would you have to make a curving approach to the...
Yes.
Not for the Seafire, I'm talking about the...
Or even the Master, yes, you had to come in on a curved approach. But it wasn't so bad as the Seafire. If you're landing on a deck, you had to be right down near the stalling speed.
We'll come to that a bit later, I think. So I imagine now that you were... The decision was being made what you were going to do, what kind of pilot you were going to be, torpedo, fighter,
yep.
Bomber. Can you tell me a little
bit
about
that? Well, I'd opted for a fighter pilot. I think because being an independent sort of character, and I wanted to be on my own. If you were going to be a torpedo bomber, you'd have a navigator behind you telling you what to do, because he was the captain, unusually. And I think in the RAF it was the other way around. But in the Fleet Air Arm, the observer navigator was a captain of the aircraft. So I opted for fighter. Fortunately, I got onto that. So the next stage then after Errol, after the Master, was to go onto Seafire straight away.
When was the decision made? When did you know that you... When did you put forward that you wanted to be a fighter pilot? Or did most people opt for fighter pilot, I suppose?
No, not always, no. I think some opted for observer, the observer type aircraft. No, I can't remember ever having contemplated the idea of not getting what I wanted. Self-centered young man, like most young men. So I got the fighter pilot, and another reason was that the fighter training took place in Dorset, not far from my home. Yeovilton was the base, the main base, but that was mostly for the Grumman Martlet and later the Hellcat. And the Seafire training was at a substation called Henstridge near Temple Coombe, about 20 miles away. And that was, again, only about 30 miles from my home in Dorset. I was then living near Lyme Regis, and it was very nice to be able to be on home ground, to be able to recognize the terrain a bit.
So you've done your month training on the Master.
Yeah.
You've passed that, you become a fire pilot. And then you're transferred back down to Dorset.
To Henstridge, yes.
To Henstridge. Mm. What was that like? Because now every time you're getting, obviously, the fewer you're in the smaller number of people, I suppose the accommodation's improving, the food's getting better, your office is
Yes, we're all sub-lieutenants. We'd Yes, the courses had broken up. I mean, people had gone. Our training course broke up when we left Canada, and people split up into different places. So I didn't actually, don't think there was anybody with me when I went to Henstridge who'd I'd been with on the course. They all gone into different branches. David Gunson, and no, I don't think so. I met a totally new group of people at Henstridge. But it was fine getting onto an operational aircraft, and it's just the mail coming. The Seafire was such a wizard, wonderful wizard is the in word in those days. wonderful aircraft to fly.
Can you tell me what it was like to arrive at Henstridge? I mean, just because this is the end of a long period.
Yes, well, it was right out in the blue, really. Temple Coombe was the nearest station, and then. I don't remember a lot of the detail. We were still in Nissen huts, but the food certainly was much better being on in the officers' mess now, the wardrooms, it's called in the Navy. There were various courses. There was an A flight, which was the in their last month of training, and then B flight, these were the dispersal units, because, of course, they all scattered round the airfield and to avoid damage being inflicted on the whole lot, big hangars and baffles. Again, I don't remember very much about Henstridge for some reason, except I made friends with the Met officer, a chap called Mitchell. Don't know what's happened to him. And we did exercises, again, more advanced kind of spotting and air-to-air, air-to-ground. But the main emphasis was on deck landing, what they called ADLs, assistant dummy deck landings. They marked out a couple of lines on the end of the runway, and the batsman, who had two ping-pong bats in his hand and guided us in to land, he had his signals, you know, to make us put more engine. He'd wind his hands round. If he thought we were too low, he'd put his hands up in the air, go up. Or if we were too high, put them down. And we had to try and spot land, or at least land between these two lines. And there had to be 120 of them successfully completed before we could go on to a carrier landing. So we were really concentrating on that, I think. At the end of that, that was our first deck landing in the Clyde, up near on the old Argus, was the real, that was the real stomach Turner.
You said the Seafire was a wizard plane. What, when you got into it and you took off for the first time, what was it you immediately noticed about
it? Well,
it
was so light and so wonderfully easy to control. The stick was a very, very light touch, and it would respond straight away. I think there were several marks of Seafire. L2C, I think, was the ones certainly that's what we meant when I went operational, and then L3. They were always improving them with it was a Merlin engine to begin with. I think later they had a Griffin, which was a 2,000 horsepower, but the Merlin, I think, was 1750 horsepower, which gave you a tremendous boost. One exercise we did was to see how high we could go, oxygen testing. Got up to 30,000, 31,000, I think. At that altitude, the air is so thin that you lose control, really, conventional aircraft. The jets, of course, can manage much more, but with the old air screw, I think it was three-bladed, I think, you couldn't really control much more. We did an oxygen test in an oxygen tent. We went into a test chamber, and they reduced the oxygen on purpose until you passed out, and then asked you to look what you were trying to write on the paper. You know, because one of the dangers of oxygen thing, lack of oxygen, is you think you're doing all right, until you pass out.
So there was no oxygen. You didn't have oxygen in the plane.
Oh yes, we did go up to 30,000. You had to start if you were going above 15,000, you had to have oxygen, 15,000 feet, and you had to start at 10,000 by putting a little on and then increasing it. But after 20,000, you couldn't survive very long. So we had oxygen, yes, for the high altitude.
And you went up as a group.
I think we did it solo and by ourselves, just as a test. You know, because there were nothing fancy involved. It was just a sheer climb up to 30,000 feet and with oxygen, of course, and in it got a canopy over the sea fire, like the old spit, and then glide down again. I can remember it was a cold day in, I suppose this was January, February. I remember a very cold day, clear day. I could look down on all the patchwork of Somerset fields, and wonderful.
What about aerial combat, mock aerial combat? How were you trained for that?
Mostly in the Link trainer. They simulated the attacking on an enemy aircraft because you had to learn deflection, aiming off. And we didn't have anything very sophisticated in those days. There was a certain site. I think later they had a site which actually plotted the deflection. So all you had to do is to put your crossed wires on the target. We had to work out the aim off and hope to get it right.
So in the Link trainer, then how would you, I don't quite understand how they would simulate.
Well, they would simulate an enemy, an aircraft, and
how were the images were.
On the screen, yes.
Dots, or were they actual filmers?
Can't remember now. We also did it with drogues, of course. Drogue is the thing behind a slow aircraft, and we would come in on a quarter attack. And
a quarter attack being?
Coming from stern, a quarter on the quarter, the port or starboard quarter, that is 45 degrees, and come in and hopefully get some hits on the drogue, and they would be count, the holes would be counted when you got home, and you had to be careful to break off quickly because the piloting aircraft was only just ahead. We did some. I can't remember doing any dive bombing there or bombing, but that all had to be part of the training because later on we were doing that in action off south of France, the spotting and bombing.
What guns did you have? You had cannons or?
No, I think the Sea Fire only had Browning 4 in each wing. The cannon were in the Hellcat, which I flew later because it was a bigger, heavier aircraft. I don't remember whether the Sea Fire had cannon. I'm afraid of my memory's gone there. The Hellcat had cannon and it had rockets as well. You could carry rocket projectiles, which were, of course, far more effective. Sea Fire's one big disadvantage was its endurance. It would only about three-quarters of an hour fuel, which we overcame on reconnaissance non-combatant work by putting a jettison tank underneath, which would give you another half an hour or so. But then if you had that, then you couldn't carry much armor or much weight of the guns or ammunition.
So when you were training on the Sea Fire, how many hours would you fly a day then if you only had an endurance of 33 quarters of an hour? You must have just made two.
Oh, no, not more than about 30, 40 minutes a time.
And how many times would you go up a day?
I mean, not more than once.
Really?
No. Because there were a lot of other things to do, you know, learning to do as well.
For example?
Well, learning navigation, and navigation is a big one.
Were there any, I mean, there must have been a lot of development going on as your training was progressing. I mean, did the Dayton computer get modified, or was there suddenly another new gadget which came in?
I don't remember anything very much new. The only, later on when we were operational, they brought in the Franks flying suit, FFS, which was one of the problems that the RAF had found was that if they were doing a dive and got into a very high speed, and then had to pull out quickly. The G force in the centrifugal force sent all the blood down to the legs and drained from the head, and you blacked out. And so they designed, Mr. Franks designed a suit which was a kind of wetsuit with a thin layer of water all right, covering the whole body, so that when you pulled out of a steep dive, instead of the blood draining, it was sort of held up so you didn't black out. I can remember that one coming in and being measured for one of those.
Sounds like it must be very uncomfortable to wear.
Not all that much. It just fitted you pretty. We had to be measured fairly tightly so that it would fit well. You know.
Radar? Was there any talk of radar? I mean, radar was operational then. Was it when you were training in the
Sea Fire? Yes. Well, I remember here. Well, ASDIC and radar. I remember hearing about it at Dartmouth before we even joined up. But I don't know that we had much to do with it ourselves, because it was operated from the ground, really. It was a, you know, aircraft. Our chief thing was aircraft identification, knowing to be able to, was it friend or foe, and ship recognition, too, is very important. We had to keep that up to date all the time, new and ships.
You were tested on this?
Oh, yes.
During the Sea Fire test?
Yes, very, very thoroughly.
Without warning, that in here... What's this?
No, I don't know about that. I think we had time to mug it up. but we were, you know, trying to keep up to date with all the things. As far as I remember, I'm afraid a lot of this has gone out of my mind, because I haven't thought of it very much. It's a different life. I think of it as a totally different life from what I've been doing since.
So we've got now to the... We've come to the end of the Sea Fire training. Obviously, you had an arrestor hook, didn't you, in the plane? How did they train you to... I mean, I know you had to land between the two lines, but there must have been, at some point, you must have, before you went into the actual deck landing, did you pick up a wire or on the...
Well, no, you just, because if you were in the right attitude coming in, you didn't have a hook on the airfield, of course, but if you were right speed, right attitude, so that when you cut the throttle, you touched the runway between those two lines... You hope that the hook would take effect.
Did you find it difficult landing in this such a precise way? I'm talking about the training, not the actual. To get 120 landings right.
Well, yes. I mean, there were obviously were failures, but I must have got past the test, because at the end of the time we went up to the Clyde for these six deck landings. On that was the real. Shadow over the future, you know, the thing everybody talked about in the wardroom. We were saying, we're going to Argus. And because it only had, I think, four wires, or maybe six or four, which meant that the ones on the carriers we later flew had more wires, about eight wires, and the barrier. Well, I think Argus had a barrier, but it meant if you didn't catch a wire, you... The Sea Fire was quite good. You could open the throttle and go around again, but not the some of the others. You couldn't have done that. The
so
Wildcat.
Can you tell me about your first deck landing then?
Yeah, well, I just remember the Argus in the Clyde off Ailsa Craig, that big rock in the middle of the Clyde, and obviously I had a lot of stomach adrenaline running fast. In fact, after the war, I developed stomach ulcers, I think, as a result of all the deck landings and some other things, too. That was another story. But I chiefly remember an accident that occurred. You know, these things do impinge themselves on your mind. There was a fellow in a Wildcat, which was slightly less powerful than the Hellcat, and didn't look as it ought to fly at all. It was a very tubby little thing with short wings. And this man, not on our course, he was a different course, but he took off and didn't get enough airspeed and just sort of went straight over and into the Clyde, and that was the end of him. That was the first casualty of the war. Of course, there were a lot later, but the first one always makes an impression on you.
The first one that happened in your direct...
Yeah, that I saw.
Orbit. Oh, I see, you actually saw it.
Mm.
So you flew up to Scotland from Dorset.
I can't remember how we got there, but
and landed at an aerodrome nearby, and then went out to do the landings on the ship. Did you go out to the ship and flew?
I think we probably went out on a boat from Greenock or Gourock or somewhere there, because the ship was refitting. They did all the refitting at Greenock in the Clyde. But Argus, I don't know. No, I can't remember. Great.
So you took off from the ship and landed on the ship?
Yes.
That first time round. Mm. So can you remember what it was like taking
off?
No,
I can't remember at all.
Really?
Taking off is not so bad. You just, because you know you can't do much about it. You put the brakes on and rev up to full throttle and then let the brakes off and hope for the best. There's nothing much else you can do about it. Landing on is the difficult thing. As I say, on the Seafire, you had to come in on a curved approach with the hood open, goggles on, leaning out of the side so that you could see the deck at all, because the nose was right up in front of you. We came in at 68 knots and stalling speed was 63, so we only had 5 knots spare. And we came in and... I must have managed them all right, I suppose. But certainly it was quite a tense time.
And there must have been that moment when the wheel touched, but you weren't sure if the hook had taken.
No, the hook touched first, usually, because it hung quite a long way down. This was another drawback of the Seafire. The hook was between the undercarriage and the tailplane. So you had to have been in the right attitude, otherwise the hook wouldn't catch. The Hellcat, which was designed as a fleet fighter for a carrier, the hook was right at the stern, aft of the tail wheel, and it therefore hung right down, and you could have the, as long as you had the tail low enough, you were pretty sure of catching a wire. But the Seafire was, I'm afraid, vulnerable on this point, and there were a lot of casualties from deck landings.
So I'm just trying to imagine what it must have felt. As you came in to land, the first thing you would notice would be this
sudden
hook caught.
Yeah, sudden deceleration. You'd know if you'd caught the wire, you'd waited for this sudden. If the wheels hadn't touched, they would have very soon would. Another characteristic of the Seafire, not so engaging, was its desire to float. When you came in and cut the throttle, most other aircraft would lose speed and drop. The Seafire had an engaging habit of just floating on a bit. He said, I want to go on flying, you know. Cut the throttle and you just go on straight on. And that was responsible for a lot of casualties. Because on the deck of a carrier, you have two barriers. I'm not sure why they went three. So with the fleet steaming into wind, which may not be the way they wanted to go, you had to steam into wind to get the wind over the flight deck, you could land on an aircraft. Instead of having to wait to strike it down into the hangar on the lift, the barriers came up, the aircraft were stashed up forward, up in the bows, and the next one could come on. So if it missed the wires, it wouldn't write off the aircraft on the bow as well. Well, that happened more often than it should have done, because, as I say, the Seafire was not designed as a fleet fighter. It was so airworthy, so floated so easily that a lot of people the hook didn't catch, either because they were going too fast, or because they floated, or because the hook was between the undercarriage and the tail wheel, didn't hang low enough.
How much time did you have if the hook didn't catch, to whack the throttle open and get out of it?
There was one famous occasion when I don't think I even touched the deck, but I remember floating and seeing the captain on the bridge just on my starboard bow. I thought I had missed it, so I opened the throttle and I got away with it. I don't know whether the chaps on the barrier whipped the barriers down. I probably owe my life to them, because, again, the Seafire's propensity for floating. Opening the throttle, I was able to go round again and try again. But not long after that, they reckoned that I was getting twitch.
We'll come to that in a bit, I think. Okay. Now, let's finish your training. So you've landed, you've made your six, how many landings did
six,
you
six stick landings, yes.
In one day you had to do this?
No, it was 2 or 3 days, I think. You know, one per day was quite enough, I think, for the first time, you know, because it was quite twitchy.
And you all, do you remember if you all passed?
I can't remember now, no. But from there we went, that was on CFIRES. I think that was the end of the Henstridge training, came at right at the end, because it was mostly for deck landings that we were doing. Well, then we were either sent to a frontline, not many, but some were sent to straight to a frontline squadron, some were sent to a second line squadron to wait until openings came up. And this was April 44, are we now, I think, just before the front.
Did you go home for a final leave?
I had a bit of leave and then was posted to Orkney for 3 weeks.
Just going back, sorry, to your final leave, I imagine Dorset at that time would have been crawling with troops, because I know where I was, because this was slowly the beginning,
yes,
the build-up towards D-Day.
Yes. No, the
oh, okay. Can we have 5 minutes?
Yep. No, I don't... Yes, we were quite near the coast at Lyme Regis, obviously, and the coastal defences were very much in evidence. But I think the troops were mostly a bit further east, around Southampton, Winchester, Portsmouth, and all around there, because that's where most of the invasion fleet set sail from. Not many from the West Country. They had that dreadful incident down at Slapton Sands, of course, but no, I don't remember seeing many troops around or Americans around when I was on leave. And so I must have had, a few days and then gone up to Scotland. I think I went by train up to Thurso and across to Kirkwall, and then to a little subsidiary station by the name of Twat. Twat was just a few runways, pretty basic conditions, but we did have a cabin, just the two of us in a cabin there, which was a bit better than those long Nissen huts at Henstridge. And I was there, I had the great fun of flying a swordfish.
But why were you sent up? I just wanted to sort of recap now, because now you've done nearly 2 years of training, haven't you?
Yeah,
this
getting
is
on.
April 44, and you started in
September 42.
So it's coming up to almost 2 years of training.
Yeah.
And they send you...
Well, it was only 3 weeks, but I mean, because there was no opening. They were waiting for... the squadron was in Northern Ireland, was forming up, and they had to make up... I was sent to Northern Ireland only 3 weeks later, 807 squadron, but I suppose they had to keep us busy. I was doing fleet support, because it's right on the edge of Scupper Flow, you see, and there was a lot of gunnery practice going on, and I was towing drogues then. And
from a swordfish,
and
what was it like going from a seafire to a swordfish?
Well, the swordfish, funnily enough, was had a lot of similar characteristics. It was very airworthy. It floated. It took off at about 50 miles and 50 or 40 knots. And some of the winds in Orkney can be strong. I remember landing once on the extension to the runway. I mean, didn't even get to the runway because it floated in and landed at about 40 knots, you know, and then just stopped. But, of course, there was no armouring. It was then purely spotting and towing drogues. Flew a fulmar and a rock, one of the old pre-seafire fighters.
What was what was a fulmar like? I mean, if we talk about the characteristics of... do you want to stop?
It's all right. We go on to the end of the reel.
Yeah. The characteristics of, say, the fulmar.
Well, I don't remember the fulmar very much. The rock, I remember because of its name, the stick after the seafire... It was like a rock. I mean, you had to sort of push it over and pull it back, the control column. I didn't like that one very much. But and the, I think the rock and the skua were much the same. But don't think I flew anything else. I could look in my logbook if you want to know any more. But the swordfish is the one I remember very much. String bag, they used to call it. But I'm very proud of the fact that I did actually fly one. It wasn't in action. It was a marvelous aircraft to fly. They were so airworthy, so, but obviously terribly vulnerable.